Chapter 6. From here, it was a 4-mile walk to his village. A mile further to the turning, to which the abominable Russell had now fiercely declined to take him, and from there a further 3 miles of winding country lane. The Saab seethed off into the night. Arthur watched it go, as stunned as a man might be who, having believed himself to be totally blind for 5 years, suddenly discovers that he had merely been wearing too large a hat. He shook his head sharply in the hope that it might dislodge some salient fact which would fall into place and make some sense of an otherwise utterly bewildering universe. But since the salient fact, if there was one, entirely failed to do this, he set off up the road again, hoping that a good vigorous walk, and maybe even some good painful blisters, would help to reassure him of his own existence at least, if not his sanity. It was 10:30 when he arrived, a fact he discovered from the steamed and greasy window of the Horse and Groom pub, in which there had hung for many years a battered old Guinness clock, which featured a picture of an emu with a pint glass jammed, rather amusingly, down its throat. This was the pub at which he had passed the fateful lunchtime, during which first his house, and then the entire planet Earth, had been demolished, or rather, had seemed to be demolished. No, damn it, had been demolished, because if it hadn't, then where the bloody heck had he been for the last 8 years, and how had he got there if not in one of those big yellow Vogon ships which the appalling Russell had just been telling him were merely drug-induced hallucinations? And yet if it had been demolished, what was he currently standing on? He jammed the brake on this line of thought, because it wasn't going to get him any further than it had the last 20 times he'd been over it. He started again. This was the pub at which he had passed the fateful lunchtime, during which whatever it was had happened, that he was going to have to sort out later, had happened. And it still didn't make sense. He started again. This was the pub in which... This was a pub. Pubs served drinks, and he couldn't half do with one. Satisfied that his jumbled thought processes had at last arrived at a conclusion, and a conclusion he was happy with, even if it wasn't the one he'd set out to achieve, he strode towards the door and stopped. A small black wire-haired terrier ran out from behind a low wall, and then, catching sight of Arthur, began to snarl. Now, Arthur knew this dog, and he knew it well. It belonged to an advertising friend of his, and was called Know-Nothing Bozo, because the way its hair stood up on its head reminded people of the President of the United States of America. And the dog knew Arthur, or at least should do. It was a stupid dog, could not even read an auto-cue, which is why some people had protested about its name. But it should at least have been able to recognise Arthur, instead of standing there, hackles raised, as if Arthur was the most fearful apparition ever to intrude upon its feeble-witted life. This prompted Arthur to go and peer at the window again, this time with an eye not for the asphyxiating emu, but for himself. Seeing himself for the first time, suddenly in a familiar context, he had to admit that the dog had a point. He looked a lot like something a farmer would use to scare birds with, and there was no doubt but that to go into the pub in his present condition would excite comment of a raucous kind. And worse still, there would doubtless be several people in there at the moment whom he knew, all of whom would be bound to bombard him with questions which, at the moment, he felt ill-equipped to deal with. Will Smithers, for instance, the owner of Know-Nothing Bozo, the non-wonder dog, an animal so stupid that it had been sacked from one of Will's own commercials for being incapable of knowing which dog food it was supposed to prefer, despite the fact that the meat in all the other bowls had had engine oil poured over it. Will would definitely be in there. Here was his dog, there was his car, a grey Porsche 928S, with a sign in the back window which read, "My other car is also a Porsche." Damn him. He stared at it and realised that he had just learnt something he hadn't known before. Will Smithers, like most of the overpaid and underscrupulous bastards Arthur knew in advertising, made a point of changing his car every August, so that he could tell people his accountant made him do it, though the truth was that his accountant was trying like hell to stop him, what with all the alimony he had to pay and so on. And this was the same car Arthur remembered him having before. The number plate proclaimed its year. Given that it was now winter, and that the event which had caused Arthur so much trouble 8 of his personal years ago had occurred at the beginning of September, less than 6 or 7 months could have passed here. He stood terribly still for a moment, and let Know-Nothing Bozo jump up and down yapping at him. He was suddenly stunned by a realisation he could no longer avoid, which was this. He was now an alien on his own world. Try as they might, no one was even going to be able to believe his story. Not only did it sound perfectly potty, but it was flatly contradicted by the simplest observable facts. Was this really the Earth? Was there the slightest possibility that he'd made some extraordinary mistake? The pub in front of him was unbearably familiar to him in every detail, every brick, every piece of peeling paint, and inside he could sense its familiar, stuffy, noisy warmth, its exposed beams, its unauthentic cast-iron light fittings, its bar sticky with beer that people he knew had put their elbows in, overlooked by cardboard cutouts of girls with packets of peanuts stapled all over their breasts. It was all the stuff of his home, his world. He even knew this blasted dog. "Hey, know nothing!" The sound of Will Smithers' voice meant he had to decide what to do quickly. If he stood his ground, he would be discovered, and the whole circus would begin. To hide would only postpone the moment, and it was bitterly cold now. The fact that it was Will made the choice easier. It wasn't that Arthur disliked him as such. Will was quite fun. It was just that he was fun in such an exhausting way, because, being in advertising, he always wanted you to know how much fun he was having, and where he'd got his jacket from. Mindful of this, Arthur hid behind a van. "Hey, Know-Nothing, what's up?" The door opened and Will came out, wearing a leather flying jacket that he'd got a mate of his at the Road Research Laboratory to crash a car into, especially, in order to get that battered look. Know-Nothing yelped with delight, and having got the attention it wanted, was happy to forget Arthur. Will was with some friends, and they had a game they played with the dog. "Commies!" they all shouted at the dog in chorus. "Commies! Commies! Commies!" The dog went berserk with barking, prancing up and down, yapping its little heart out, beside itself, in transports of ecstatic rage. They all laughed and cheered it on, then gradually dispersed to their various cars and disappeared into the night. "Well, that clears one thing up," thought Arthur from behind the van. "This is quite definitely the planet I remember." Chapter 7. His house was still there. How or why, he had no idea. He had decided to go and have a look while he was waiting for the pub to empty, so that he could go and ask the landlord for a bed for the night when everyone else had gone. And there it was. He hurriedly let himself in with a key he kept under a stone frog in the garden, because, astoundingly, the phone was ringing. He had heard it faintly all the way up the lane, and started to run as soon as he realized where the sound was coming from. The door had to be forced open because of the astonishing accumulation of junk mail on the doormat. It jammed itself stuck on what he would later discover were 14 identical, personally addressed invitations to apply for a credit card he already had, 17 identical threatening letters for non-payment of bills on a credit card he didn't have, 33 identical letters saying that he personally had been specially selected as a man of taste and discrimination, who knew what he wanted and where he was going in today's sophisticated jet-setting world, and would he therefore like to buy some grotty wallet. And also a dead tabby kitten. He rammed himself through the relatively narrow opening afforded by all this, stumbled through a pile of wine offers that no discriminating connoisseur would want to miss, slithered over a heap of beach villa holidays, blundered up the dark stairs to his bedroom, and got to the phone just as it stopped ringing. He collapsed panting onto his cold, musty-smelling bed, and for a few minutes stopped trying to prevent the world from spinning round his head in the way it obviously wanted to. When it had enjoyed its little spin and had calmed down a bit, Arthur reached out for his bedside light, not expecting it to come on. To his surprise, it did. This appealed to Arthur's sense of logic. Since the electricity board cut him off without fail every time he paid his bill, it seemed only reasonable that they should leave him connected when he didn't. Sending them money obviously only drew attention to yourself. The room was much as he had left it, i.e. festeringly untidy, though the effect was muted a little by a thick layer of dust. Half-read books and magazines nestled amongst piles of half-used towels. Half pairs of socks reclined in half-drunk cups of coffee. What was once a half-eaten sandwich had now half-turned into something that Arthur entirely didn't want to know about. Bung a fork of lightning through this lot, he thought to himself, and he'd start the evolution of life off all over again. There was only one thing in the room that was different. For a moment or so he couldn't see what the one thing was that was different, because it too was covered in a film of disgusting dust. Then his eyes caught it and stopped. It was next to a battered old television, on which it was only possible to watch Open University study courses, because if it tried to show anything more exciting, it would break down. It was a box. Arthur pushed himself up on his elbows and peered at it. It was a grey box with a kind of dull lustre to it. It was a cubic grey box, just over a foot on a side. It was tied with a single grey ribbon, knotted into a neat bow on the top. He got up, walked over, and touched it in surprise. Whatever it was clearly gift-wrapped, neatly and beautifully, and was waiting for him to open it. Cautiously, he picked it up and carried it back to the bed. He brushed the dust off the top and loosened the ribbon. The top of the box was a lid, with a flap tucked into the body of the box. He untucked it and looked into the box. In it was a glass globe, nestling in fine grey tissue paper. He drew it out carefully. It wasn't a proper globe because it was open at the bottom, or, as Arthur realized turning it over, at the top, with a thick rim. It was a bowl, a fish bowl. It was made of the most wonderful glass, perfectly transparent, yet with an extraordinary silver-grey quality, as if crystal and slate had gone into its making. Arthur slowly turned it over and over in his hands. It was one of the most beautiful objects he had ever seen, but he was entirely perplexed by it. He looked into the box, but other than the tissue paper, there was nothing. On the outside of the box, there was nothing. He turned the bowl round again. It was wonderful. It was exquisite. But it was a fish bowl. He tapped it with his thumbnail, and it rang with a deep and glorious chime, which was sustained for longer than seemed possible. And when at last it faded, seemed not to die away, but to drift off into other worlds, as into a deep sea dream. Entranced, Arthur turned it round yet again, and this time the light from the dusty little bedside lamp caught it at a different angle, and glittered on some fine abrasions on the fishbowl's surface. He held it up, adjusting the angle to the light, and suddenly saw clearly the finely engraved shapes of words shadowed on the glass. "So long," they said, "and thanks." And that was all. He blinked and understood nothing. For fully 5 more minutes he turned the object round and around, held it to the light at different angles, tapped it for its mesmerizing chime, and pondered on the meaning of the shadowy letters, but could find none. Finally he stood up, filled the bowl with water from the tap, and put it back on the table next to the television. He shook the little babelfish from his ear and dropped it, wriggling, into the bowl. He wouldn't be needing it any more, except for watching foreign movies. He returned to lie on his bed and turned out the light. He lay still and quiet. He absorbed the enveloping darkness, slowly relaxed his limbs from end to end, eased and regulated his breathing, gradually cleared his mind of all thought, closed his eyes, and was completely incapable of getting to sleep. The night was uneasy with rain. The rain clouds themselves had now moved on, and were currently concentrating their attention on a small transport cafe just outside Bournemouth. But the sky through which they had passed had been disturbed by them, and now wore a damply ruffled air, as if it didn't know what else it might not do if further provoked. The moon was out in a watery way. It looked like a ball of paper from the back pocket of jeans that have just come out from the washing machine, and which only time and ironing would tell if it was an old shopping list or a 5-pound note. The wind flicked about a little, like the tail of a horse that's trying to decide what sort of mood it's in tonight, and a bell somewhere chimed midnight. A skylight creaked open. It was stiff and had to be jiggled and persuaded a little, because the frame was slightly rotten and the hinge had at some time in its life been rather sensibly painted over. But eventually it was open. A strut was found to prop it, and a figure struggled out into the narrow gully between the opposing pitches of the roof. It stood and watched the sky in silence. The figure was completely unrecognizable as the wild-looking creature who had burst crazily into the cottage a little over an hour ago. Gone was the ragged, threadbare dressing gown, smeared with the mud of 100 worlds, stained with junk food condiment from 100 grimy spaceports. Gone was the tangled mane of hair. gone the long and knotted beard, flourishing ecosystem and all. Instead, there was Arthur Dent, the smooth and casual, in corduroys and a chunky sweater. His hair was cropped and washed, his chin clean-shaven. Only the eyes still said that whatever it was the universe thought it was doing to him, he would still like it pleased to stop. They were not the same eyes with which he had last looked out at this particular scene, and the brain which interpreted the images the eyes resolved was not the same brain. There had been no surgery involved, just the continual wrenching of experience. The night seemed like an alive thing to him at this moment, the dark earth around him a being in which he was rooted. He could feel like a tingle on distant nerve ends, the flood of a far river, the roll of invisible hills, the knot of heavy rain clouds parked somewhere away to the south. He could sense, too, the thrill of being a tree, which was something he hadn't expected. He knew that it felt good to curl your toes in the earth, but he'd never realized it could feel quite as good as that. He could sense an almost unseemly wave of pleasure reaching out to him all the way from the New Forest. He must try the summer, he thought, and see what having leaves felt like. From another direction, he felt the sensation of being a sheep startled by a flying saucer, but it was virtually indistinguishable from the feeling of being a sheep startled by anything else it ever encountered, for they were creatures who learnt very little on their journey through life, and would be startled to see the sun rising in the morning, and astonished by all the green stuff in the field. He was surprised to find that he could feel the sheep being startled by the sun that morning, and the morning before, and being startled by a clump of trees the day before that. He could go further and further back, but it got dull because all it consisted of was sheep being startled by things they had been startled by the day before. He left the sheep and let his mind drift outwards sleepily in developing ripples. It felt the presence of other minds, hundreds of them, thousands in a web, some sleepy, some sleeping, some terribly excited, one fractured. One fractured. He passed it fleetingly and tried to feel for it again, but it eluded him like the other card with an apple on it in Pelmanism. He felt a spasm of excitement because he knew instinctively who it was, or at least knew who it was he wanted it to be, and once you know what it is you want to be true, instinct is a very useful device for enabling you to know that it is. He instinctively knew that it was Fenny, and that he wanted to find her. But he could not. By straining too much for it, he could feel he was losing the strange new faculty, so he relaxed the search and let his mind wander more easily once more. And again he felt the fracture. Again he couldn't find it. This time, whatever his instinct was busy telling him it was all right to believe, he wasn't certain that it was Fenny, or perhaps it was a different fracture this time. It had the same disjointed quality, but it seemed a more general feeling of fracture, deeper, not a single mind, maybe not a mind at all. It was different. He let his mind sink slowly and widely into the earth, rippling, seeping, sinking. He was following the earth through its days, drifting with the rhythms of its myriad pulses, seeping through the webs of its life, swelling with its tides, turning with its weight. Always the fracture kept returning, a dull, disjointed, distant ache. And now he was flying through a land of light. The light was time. The tides of it were days receding. The fracture he had sensed, the second fracture, lay in the distance before him, across the land, the thickness of a single hair, across the dreaming landscape of the days of earth. And suddenly he was upon it. He danced dizzily over the edge as the dreamland dropped sheer away beneath him, a stupefying precipice into nothing, him wildly twisting, clawing at nothing, flailing in horrifying space, spinning, falling. Across the jagged chasm had been another land, another time, an older world, not fractured from, but hardly joined. Two earths. He woke. A cold breeze brushed the feverish sweat standing on his forehead. The nightmare was spent, and so, he felt, was he. His shoulders dropped. He gently rubbed his eyes with the tips of his fingers. At last he was sleepy as well as very tired. As to what it meant, if it meant anything at all, he would think about it in the morning, for now he would go to bed and sleep, his own bed, his own sleep. He could see his house in the distance, and wondered why this was. It was silhouetted against the moonlight, and he recognised its rather dull, blockish shape. He looked about him and noticed that he was about 18 inches above the rose bushes of one of his neighbours, John Ainsworth. His rose bushes were carefully tended, pruned back for the winter, strapped to canes and labelled, and Arthur wondered what he was doing above them. He wondered what was holding him there, and when he discovered that nothing was holding him there, he crashed awkwardly to the ground. He picked himself up, brushed himself down, and hobbled back to his house on a sprained ankle. He undressed and toppled into bed. While he was asleep, the phone rang again. It rang for fully 15 minutes, and caused him to turn over twice. It never, however, stood a chance of waking him up. Chapter 8. Arthur awoke feeling wonderful, absolutely fabulous, refreshed, overjoyed to be home, bouncing with energy, hardly disappointed at all to discover it was the middle of February. He almost danced to the fridge, found the three least hairy things in it, put them on a plate, and watched them intently for 2 minutes. Since they made no attempt to move within that time, he called them breakfast and ate them. Between them, they killed a virulent space disease he'd picked up without knowing it in the Phlegethon gas swamps a few days earlier, which otherwise would have killed off half the population of the Western Hemisphere, blinded the other half, and driven everyone else psychotic and sterile. So the Earth was lucky there. He felt strong, he felt healthy. He vigorously cleared away the junk mail with a spade and then buried the cat. Just as he was finishing that, the phone went, but he let it ring while he maintained a moment's respectful silence. Whoever it was would ring back if it was important. He kicked the mud off his shoes and went back inside. There had been a small number of significant letters in the piles of junk. Some documents from the council, dated 3 years earlier, relating to the proposed demolition of his house, and some other letters about the setting up of a public inquiry into the whole bypass scheme in the area. There was also an old letter from Greenpeace, the ecological pressure group to which he occasionally made contributions, asking for help with their scheme to release dolphins and orcas from captivity, and some postcards from friends vaguely complaining that he never got in touch these days. He collected these things together and put them in a cardboard file, which he marked things to do. Since he was feeling so vigorous and dynamic that morning, he even added the word urgent. He unpacked his towel and a few other odd bits and pieces from the plastic bag he had acquired at the Port Brasta mega market. The slogan on the side was a clever and elaborate pun in lingua Centauri, which was completely incomprehensible in any other language, and therefore entirely pointless for a duty-free shop at a spaceport. The bag also had a hole in it, so he threw it away. He realized with a sudden twinge that something else must have dropped out in the small spacecraft that had brought him to Earth, kindly going out of its way to drop him right beside the A303. He had lost his battered and space-worn copy of the thing which had helped him find his way across the unbelievable wastes of space he had traversed. He had lost the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Well, he told himself, this time I really won't be needing it again. He had some calls to make. He had decided how to deal with the massive contradictions his return journey precipitated, which was that he would simply brazen it out. He phoned the BBC and asked to be put through to his department head. "Oh, hello, Arthur Dent here. Look, sorry I haven't been in for 6 months, but I've gone mad." "Oh, not to worry," said his department head. "Thought it was probably something like that. Happens here all the time. How soon can we expect you?" "When do hedgehogs stop hibernating?" "Sometime in the spring, I think. Well, I'll be in shortly after that. Righty-ho." He flipped through the yellow pages and made a short list of numbers to try. "Oh, hello. Is that the Old Elms Hospital? Yes, I was just phoning to see if I could have a word with Fenella. Good Lord, silly me. I'll forget my own name next. Fenella. Isn't this ridiculous? A patient of yours, dark-haired girl, came in last night." "I'm afraid we don't have any patients called Fenella." "Oh, don't you? I meant Fiona, of course. We just call her Fen. I'm sorry. Goodbye." Click. Six conversations along these lines began to take their toll on his mood of vigorous, dynamic optimism, and he decided that before it deserted him entirely, he would take it down to the pub and parade it a little. He had had the perfect idea for explaining away every inexplicable weirdness about himself at a stroke, and he whistled to himself as he pushed open the door which had so daunted him last night. "Arthur!" He grinned cheerfully at the boggling eyes that stared at him from all corners of the pub, and told them all what a wonderful time he'd had in Southern California. Chapter 9. He accepted another pint and took a pull at it. Of course, I had my own personal alchemist, too. You what? He was getting silly, and he knew it. Exuberance and Hall and Woodhouse Bess Bitter was a mixture to be wary of, but one of the first effects it has is to stop you being wary of things, and the point at which Arthur should have stopped and explained no more was the point at which he started instead to get inventive. Oh, yes, he insisted with a happy glazed smile. It's why I've lost so much weight. What? Said his audience. Oh, yes, he said again. The Californians have rediscovered alchemy. Oh, yes. He smiled again. Only, he said, it's a much more useful form than that which in... He paused thoughtfully to let a little grammar assemble itself in its head, in which the ancients used to practice it. Or at least, he added, failed to practice it. They couldn't get it to work, you know. Nostradamus and that lot couldn't cut it. Nostradamus, said one of his audience. I didn't think he was an alchemist, said another. I thought, said a third, he was a seer. He became a seer, said Arthur to his audience, the component parts of which were beginning to bob and blur a little, because he was such a lousy alchemist. You should know that. He took another pull at his beer. It was something he had not tasted for 8 years. He tasted it and tasted it. What has alchemy got to do, asked a bit of the audience, with losing weight? I'm glad you asked that, said Arthur, very glad, and I will now tell you what the connection is between... He paused. Between those two things, the things you mentioned, I'll tell you. He paused and manoeuvred his thoughts. It was like watching oil tankers doing 3-point turns in the English Channel. They've discovered how to turn excess body fat into gold, he said in a sudden blurt of coherence. You're kidding. Oh, yes, he said. No, he corrected himself. They have. He rounded on the doubting part of his audience, which was all of it, so it took a little while to round on it completely. Have you been to California? He demanded. Do you know the sort of stuff they do there? 3 members of his audience said they had, and that he was talking nonsense. You haven't seen anything, insisted Arthur. Oh, yes, he added, because someone was offering to buy another round. The evidence, he said, pointing at himself, and not missing by more than 2 inches, is before your eyes. 14 hours in a trance, he said. In a tank, in a trance. I was in a tank. I think, he added after a thoughtful pause, I already said that. He waited patiently until the next round was duly distributed. He composed the next bit of the story in his mind, which was going to be something about the tank needing to be oriented along a line dropped perpendicularly from the pole star to a baseline drawn between Mars and Venus, and was about to start trying to say it when he decided to give it a miss. Long time, he said, and said, in a tank, in a trance. He looked round severely at his audience to make sure it was all following attentively. He resumed. Where was I? He said. In a trance, said one. In a tank, said another. Oh, yes, said Arthur. Thank you. And slowly, he said, pressing onwards, slowly, 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 all your excess body fat turns to... He paused for effect. He paused for breath. Subcutaneous gold, which you can have surgically removed. Getting out of the tank is hell. What did you say? I was just clearing my throat. I think you doubt me. I was clearing my throat. She was clearing her throat, confirmed a significant part of the audience in a low rumble. Oh, yes, said Arthur. All right. And you then split the proceeds... He paused again for a maths break. 50-50 with the alchemist. Make a lot of money. He looked swayingly around at his audience and could not help but be aware of an air of scepticism about their jumbled faces. He felt very affronted by this. How else, he demanded, could I afford to have my face dropped? Friendly arms began to help him home. Listen, he protested as the cold February breeze brushed his face. Looking lived in is all the rage in California at the moment. You've got to look as if you've seen the galaxy. A life, I mean. You've got to look as if you've seen life. That's what I got, a face drop. Give me 8 years, I said. I hope being 30 doesn't come back into fashion or I've wasted a lot of money. He lapsed into silence for a while as the friendly arms continued to help him along the lane to his house. Got in yesterday, he mumbled. I'm very, very, very happy to be home, or somewhere very like it. Jet lag, muttered one of his friends. Long trip from California. Really mucks you up for a couple of days. I don't think he's been there at all, muttered another. I wonder where he has been, and what's happened to him. After a little sleep, Arthur got up and pottered around the house a bit. He felt woozy and a little low, still disoriented by the journey. He wondered how he was going to find Fenny. He sat and looked at the fishbowl. He tapped it again, and despite being full of water and a small yellow babelfish, which was gulping its way round rather dejectedly, it still chimed its deep and resonant chime as clearly and mesmerically as before. "Someone is trying to thank me," he thought to himself. He wondered who and for what. End of side 3.